energy and culture, the God wrestle. Mark did a lively session the other day on energy and economics. And we needed to substitute today because we weren't sure if Erling would be back in time, and if he were back in time, whether he would feel up to doing a session right away, and gave the man a day off. And so this is a substitute for his session, which will be picked up probably tomorrow. But I thought, since I am, in a sense, filling in, I would choose a topic that would also relate to that energy issue, but come at it very differently and talk about the cultural religious dimensions of energy. The subtitle is The God Wrestle. The image is from Genesis, the 32nd chapter. You all know that when Jacob was going to meet his brother Esau, did it with some fear and trepidation because his brother had threatened to kill him. He camped out on the banks of the river Jabbok, and in the night, a night visitor mugged him, or some such thing, and they engaged in a long wrestle until break of day. Jacob insisting that he, at least if he wasn't going to win, receive a blessing from the night visitor, and his thigh was thrown painfully out of joint, you recall, and the night visitor gave Jacob a new name. He was no longer to be Jacob. In Hebrew, there's a double play on that name. It can mean the trickster. You remember Jacob and Esau, that Jacob was always tricking somebody. He was no longer the trickster. He was given a new name. He was to be Israel, a name that meant a special bearing of God's promise and a range of responsibility. So it is a story about the transformation of identity through a process of struggle and through a process of a wrestling that one did not voluntarily choose. He did not invite the night visitor to attack him. My contention is that the culture of industrial society is engaged now in a kind of God wrestle. We have brought ourselves to a certain point. In order to get to another point, we are in a time of transition, I would argue, but a time of struggle. And the question is whether or not there might even be a transformation so thoroughgoing that we might talk about a changed identity. So I'm doing what my colleagues in biblical studies tell us not to do, and what Jim Fish might be aghast at. I'm following the steps of Philo and of Alexander and simply allegorizing out of sight. But if that can just be an image, it is an image of the God wrestle, an image of the transformation, unwilling transformation, which nonetheless brings about a changed identity. And I'm asking whether industrial society is at that point, and we will get into that by looking at some of the cultural dimensions around energy. The second thing I want to do as part of setting the stage is have us simply read the poem Chicago, or I will read it and you read along silently. I do this to highlight two things. One, it is to me a kind of quintessential American poem. There is a lot of American identity in this poem, and we can talk about that later. Secondly, it's just filled with the energy of a driving economy. And so the relationship of American identity, the identity of industrial society, to this picture of a driving, highly energized economy. Both those things are in Carl Sandburg's poem. Hog butcher for the world. Tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads. I love that image, just playing with railroads. And the nation's freight handler, stormy, husky, brawling, city of the big shoulders. They tell me you are wicked, and I believe them, for I have seen your painted women under the gas lamps luring the farm boys. And they tell me you are crooked, and I answer, yes, it is true. I have seen the gunman kill and go free to kill again. And they tell me you are brutal, and my reply is, on the faces of women and children, I have seen the marks of wanton hunger. And having answered so, I turn once more to those who sneer at this my city, and I give them back the sneer and say to them, come and show me another city with lifted head, singing, so proud to be alive and coarse and strong and cunning. Flinging magnetic curses amid the toil of piling job on job, here is a tall, bold slugger set vivid against the little, soft cities. Oh, what disdain there is for that which is little and soft. The contempt in that phrase. Fierce is a dog with tongue lapping for action. Cunning is a savage pitted against the wilderness. Bareheaded, shoveling, wrecking, planning, building, breaking, rebuilding. Under the smoke, dust all over his mouth. Laughing with white teeth under the terrible burden of destiny, laughing as a young man laughs, laughing even as an ignorant fighter laughs who has never lost a battle, bragging and laughing that under his wrist is the pulse and under his ribs the heart of the people, laughing. Laughing the stormy, husky, brawling laughter of youth, half naked, sweating, proud to be hog butcher, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads, and freight handler to the nation. Okay. Sometimes I wish I knew something about literature and could teach it. I think I'd take 14 weeks on that poem as a way in to American life and industrial life in general, but particular our own nation with its frontier experience and a lot of other strains. One last item to set the stage. I have put on the board a good New Testament word. Oikos is the Greek word for house. And it is the root word for economics, for ecology, and for ecumenics. All of those relate to caring for the household. And so in Greek political philosophy, and then in the New Testament materials, you have this picture of the household with these varied dimensions. It's going to be interesting, I think, maybe later in the hour, to pick some of these connections up, because we've lost the connection between them. We don't simultaneously think of ecumenical as related to economical, as related to ecological, but they have their roots in a common place, and that word oikos gets added. Incidentally, it's a good New Testament word, too, to talk about the oikonomia of God. And so I put, like Paul does, and so I put that up there, to talk about the economy of God. I don't know if you teach the divine economy there at Luther College or not, Mark, but that's what we teach here at Holden, is the divine economy. All right. Daniel Bell, in a book called The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism, writes about a certain unspoken consensus that has been characteristic of much of American history. And I'm quoting now from that volume. In the United States, there have been three unspoken assumptions. One, that the values of the individual were to be maximized. That, two, rising material wealth would dissolve all strains resulting from inequality, and three, that the continuity of experience would provide solutions for future problems. Abundance was, Bell says, the American surrogate for socialism. Yet, he goes on, all these assumptions have now broken down. Groups and the community have their claims, not just individuals. Rising wealth has not redeemed inequalities and has in fact brought new problems in its wake. And experience is no longer a sure guide to the complex technical problems of a modern society. And the values underlying the assumptions of material well-being and achievement are now also being called into question. So Bell goes on, some new purposes have to be established by the body politic. Some new assumptions, he says, have to be laid down. Such a task cannot be evaded. The consumer-oriented free enterprise society no longer morally satisfies the citizenry as it once did, and a new public philosophy will have to be created in order that something we recognize as a liberal society may survive. Well, Bell then takes up in the book the beginnings of what he hopes will be a contribution to a new public philosophy if the one that has guided us is no longer adequate. And Daniel Bell is among those who are sometimes cited as, or I should say he is sometimes cited as one of the group called the neoconservatives these days. I don't think that fits him as in the same way that it fits others, but he has a strong influence in high policy circles. He's a sociologist from Harvard. When Bell goes to look for a new public philosophy, he reaches back into Greek classical thought, and he finds there a guiding image, and that image is an image that he calls the public household. We ought to see our society and even the world as a single public household, an oikos, the word up here, meaning public household, the polis writ large. Oikos, as I mentioned, is the root of our words economics, ecology, and ecumenical. Economics is management of the household. That is providing for the material well-being of the household's members and managing the household well. Ecumenical is from oikoumene, which is the Greek word meaning the whole inhabited world. The World Council of Churches has a nice symbol of the oikoumene, the whole world in God. So oikoumene, the public household is the whole inhabited world. That means viewing, ecumenical means viewing the household members as a single family and fostering that family's unity. That's why we talk about ecumenical relationships, fostering unity. Ecology is knowledge of the interdependence in which the life of the household consists and upon which it depends. Now, I just want to post that there and go on then now to talking about the way in which particular forms of energy have permitted us a different way of looking at the world than that of viewing it as a single oikos, as one public household. Jeremy Rifkin, some of you know Jeremy Rifkin's books. Mary has some in the bookstore. I think she has, what is the one? The Emerging Order, and the subtitle is God in an Age of Scarcity. And then a newer book called Entropy on Energy and Culture. Well, Jeremy Rifkin, who is usually so insightfully wrong on so many things, is, I think, right when he says, and I quote, "Every civilization lives off a resource base which provides the context for the types of institutions, the technologies, and the worldviews that are developed." Let me go through that again because I want to work with it. Every civilization lives off a resource base which provides the context, the setting, for the types of institutions, the technologies, and the worldviews, the picture of reality that people carry around in their heads and on the basis of which they act, the worldviews that are developed. And the resource base to which Rifkin refers is that of non-renewable energy resources, chiefly fossil fuels, and also precious minerals. He's saying that because we've a particular resource base, namely non-renewables and precious minerals, we've developed certain kinds of institutions, or that's provided the context in which those might develop, where they couldn't elsewhere, certain technologies, and it's affected the way in which we see ourselves and the world around us. And upon these non-renewables, industrial society has been built, both capitalist and socialist. And Rifkin goes on, and Heilbrunner and many others, they look alike at their foundations, and for the reason that they're both drawing upon the same resource base. And upon these as well, our worldview resides. What is that worldview? And what is its connection to our energy base? The non-renewables, by which we mean, or the way, I'll go through the order in which they built, or allowed the building of industrial society. First coal, and then oil and natural gas, and then uranium, and then now all of them together. Those non-renewables permitted a massive departure from hunter-gatherer societies and from agrarian societies, a departure that we call industrial civilization. Industrial civilization rests upon what Rifkin calls a stored sun energy base. The non-renewables are, in effect, stored sun. Pre-industrial society, whether hunter-gatherer or agrarian, had to wait around for nature to yield its fruits in due season. You had to live by the rising and the going down of the sun and by the movements of the seasons. The non-renewables have permitted us to bypass some of nature's cycles and seasons and to use energy resources far faster than nature's clock reproduces them. We could, so to speak, turn the sun on and off at will. That is, energy which had its source in the sun was at our disposal at a speed that was different from that that characterized earlier societies. That was something which is only dimly known to pre-industrial societies. For us, it's our very existence. Now, even in agricultural America, which is also industrialized. With this energy base, we could create, and we have created, the French phrase, a nature artificielle, an inorganic environment. That has, Elizabeth Dodson Gray and others have said, gone to our head and has transformed our minds, shaping the way that we see and understand ourselves, the world about us, and I'm going to argue even God. It has fundamentally altered our picture of ourselves and the world and our place in the scheme of things and our stature before God. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, writing from prison in the 1940s, includes this cryptic observation as he interprets a certain historical process. Quote, "The aim, to be independent of nature. Nature was formerly conquered by spiritual means, with us by technical organization of all kinds. Our immediate environment is not nature, but organization." That's natur artificiel. Our immediate environment is an inorganic environment of our own crafting. This technical conquest of nature, in order to be free of nature's limits and vagaries and onslaughts, has been astonishingly successful. But I want to argue it has permitted a massive illusion that now greatly imperils us and will, I think, lead to something like a God vessel, where our own self-understanding is challenged and we end up maybe even having to give up one name and take on another, if you use the biblical imagery for identity, which is naming. Remember in the Genesis story, Adam names the animals. It's a way of talking about identity. If you, or the clock, restricted me to the Wheaties box top space, and I had to state the illusion in 25 words or less, it would be something like this. Our energy base has allowed us to believe we could have a world of our own making. We could have a world of our own making. And that's the driving dream, I'm contending, of both industrial capitalism and industrial socialism. I think that's the dream that's reflected in that poem, Chicago. We can have a world of our own making. In what are the contours of this dream? In our planetary house, in our oikos, we've turned the relationship of the economic order and the ecosystem upside down. All economic life, and I'm sure Mark would agree, is totally dependent upon the ecosystem, the living skin of organic and inorganic matter that's constantly in process and awesomely complex relationships. But given that utter dependence upon that planetary skin, the governing influences, then, you would say, ought to flow from the biophysical world to the economic world. That ought to set the terms of the relationship. Industrial society has reversed the relationship. Economic life has dictated the terms of treatment of the biophysical world, rather than nature's requirements setting the framework for our economic order. But of course, we didn't believe that that dependence upon the ecosystem is total. We still don't. That, I think, is the crack in the cosmic egg. The illusion, behind the illusion, that we could have a world of our own making. I like the first line. No, I don't like it. Intellectually, I find it amusing. The first line of an article on the environment in economics. And it goes like this, quote, "Man was probably always worried, has probably always worried about the environment because man was once totally dependent on it." Once? Totally dependent on it? No longer? Totally dependent on it? I think that line is the PhD level equivalent of the 4-year-old's contention that milk comes from the store. Even Bonhoeffer's observation can easily play into our illusion, quote, "Our immediate environment is not nature, but organization." All of the material aspects of organization, building, streets, power, transportation, communications, tools, are varied forms of nature. Our immediate environment is also nature. This is humanly transformed nature. Few economists have been so acutely aware of the relationship of economic system to ecosystem as Kenneth Boulding. I think it's partly because of Boulding's deep Quaker sense for the larger mysteries of life. Boulding, long time ago, wrote the following. "Economists in particular have failed to come to grips with the ultimate consequences of the transition from the open to the closed earth. The closed earth of the future requires economic principles that are somewhat different from those of the open earth of the past. The Earth has become a single spaceship. Bowling was one of the people, along with Bucky Fuller, who first used that image. The Earth has become a single spaceship without unlimited reservoirs of anything, either for extraction or for pollution, and in which, therefore, man must find his place in a cyclical ecological system. I think that was written about 1966 or so. I'm going to return to this image of a spaceship. Here, I want to underscore something that I find also potentially very misleading, even with Bowling sensitivity. It is not the closed Earth of the future as contrasted with the open Earth of the past. The Earth has always been closed. Many societies have known that. Industrial society is discovering it rather rudely and with some surprise almost daily, that creation, as fashioned by God, has its inherent, is inherently ecological and closed. What has permitted this illusion of independence? A part of nature itself has permitted it. A part that on a human time scale represents a virtually fixed endowment, namely non-renewable energy resources. What the non-renewables permitted us was a basically different organization of an economic life, industrial society, capitalist and socialist. But the utter dependence of the economic order upon the ecosystem isn't thereby fundamentally altered one whit. Indeed, there is an enormous irony here, namely that technology, as Herman Daly has pointed out, has merely substituted non-renewable resources for renewables, which is more of an increase than a decrease in dependence. If you're dependent upon a fixed endowment of nature, a fixed part of nature that isn't going to renew itself, you're more dependent upon at least that aspect of nature than if you were fashioning a society from non-renewables. I mean, that must be the delight of the gods to have an irony of those proportions, to claim your independence on the basis of severe dependence upon a fixed portion of nature. A world of our own making. Now, I want to explore the mind set, the culture that lives by that kind of, I think theology would call it hubris, a kind of arrogance. Bowling's image for wresting us away from the flat earth view, where the world is infinite in extent and there are always frontiers waiting to be crossed, his image for moving us away from that is the image of the earth as a spaceship. Friends, there are no accidental cultural images or pictures. And this one's caught on. Why? Is it because we've learned from ecology about closed systems, everything's connected to everything else, you can never do merely one thing, there's no such thing as a free lunch? I think it's caught on for that reason. But it's caught on for another reason, and it's far subtler and far more significant, I think. The image of the Earth as a spaceship fits the dominant image of humanity that has guided us at least since the Enlightenment, at least for a couple hundred of years. The master image for these last couple of hundred years has been the image of mastery itself. A world of our own making, under our control, which is outside us, which is of our constructing, and which we guide and fashion. The spaceship is a human construct. It is kind of the supreme nature artificielle in organic environment. It's the grand exemplum of our energy-intensive, capital-intensive, fine-tuned technological wizardry. You can't do better than the space shuttle and the spaceship. The best symbol that we can muster to exhibit the humble creatureliness of planet Earth is the very symbol by which we also innocently reflect our supposed sovereign break. from the whole of nature. Now the gods are in stitches. What is a spaceship to do, anyway? A spaceship is to conquer space, right? Think about that phrase. We as conquerors of space. Conquer space? Conquer space? Is that something like harnessing the sun? Which is what we use when we talk about developing benign sources of energy. Same image. Image of mastery and self. Conquest. Control. It's part of seeing ourselves as co-creators with God, which is a word from bad theology of late. It's a little bit like someone in this room being Miss Universe. Just wonderful pictures of our picture of ourselves in the scheme of things. This extension of mastery and conquest as I'll call it our cultural guidance system, the way in which we see things and respond, is really extraordinary. I teach next door to American University. I was over in the student center one day, and on the bulletin board advertising services to students, on the panel reserved for campus ministry, was this advertisement. Interpersonal skill building groups. In these 10 session skill focused groups, students will be taught to monitor and master anxiety. Using improved social skills by learning to be appropriately assertive. The offer went on to speak of designing experiences and acquiring the skills to build trust. Now go back to Chicago. Go back to Chicago. We're building, breaking, wrecking, rebuilding, planning. Now it's the psyche as well as nature outside of us that is the subject of human transformation in our own design. We are the transformers of nature, society, and psyche by the image of mastery. All of this is done, I didn't give this poor advertisement its due. All of this is done in a workshop. You take your psyche to the shop and work on it. Actually, that's a good idea. We've got our wood shop here, and so on. We ought to have a psyche workshop. This is a psyche shop. This is the world of those of us who work to get control of our lives. It is, in fact, an engineering view of the world. Even when the world to be designed and monitored and mastered is the world within. Well, we could go on and on about that. In the history of thought, it's a way of talking about, for a few centuries now, a notion of the self as the imperial self, where we are set over against the world, and we are the fashioners, manipulators of it. The world is essentially mechanism, and we are managers. The world is essentially loose hardware, and we are engineers. That runs from B.F. Skinner to David Stockman to campus workshops. What are some of the other dimensions of industrial society's horizons? There's a certain dynamism in industrial orders, whether they're capitalists or socialists, and I just refer you again to the poem, Chicago. And it's possible because of stored sun. If you had to wait upon the seasons all the time, upon nature's regular cycles, you couldn't do the kind of thing that you can do here. And that speeds up everything, or makes it possible to speed up everything by constructing artificia in the inorganic environments. Then you flip the lights on, you can work all night if you want, so you can work three shifts a day. Well, you can't work three shifts a day if you're in the hunter-gatherer society. I mean, it's dark half the time. I had a brief sojourn in Africa. One of the amusing stories that I was told is one which reflects a different mindset than this one of ours, which is driving imperial mastery. I had a friend who received a cable. He should get to his destination as soon as possible. He checked the train schedule. He jumped into his Land Rover and he bounced down the road to the station at Ngaoundere, Cameroon. He jumped out and he pursued the train, which was just pulling out of the station. Well, I've been on that train. You can catch it. And so he starts running after him. The conductor yelled to this pursuing missionary and said, "Take your time. Lots of time. This is yesterday's train." This is, I mean, the guy had at least 24 hours. That conductor's response, I'm submitting, was lodged in a charming fashion, right in the midst between pre-industrial society and kind of the factory time, clock time, of an inorganic environment where we set the time. So, there you are. Okay. I think I'm about finished here. We've got the poem in front of us. I'll come back to Bell and then I'll just close. Modern culture, Bell writes, is defined by the extraordinary freedom to ransack the world's storehouse and to engorge any and every style it comes upon. Such freedom comes from the fact that the axial principle of modern culture is the expression and remaking of the self. Remember, we talked about transformation of psyche? The expression and remaking of the self in order to achieve self-realization and self-fulfillment. That's what distinguishes modern culture, a view that we can remake our own selves in order to achieve those. And in its search there is, he says, a denial of any limits or boundaries to experience. It, modern culture, is a reaching out for all experience. Nothing is forbidden. All is to be explored. That's what the world is there for, our exploration. A world of our own making, nothing is forbidden, all is to be explored. Self-managed, self-fulfillment, without limits, wrecking, planning, building, breaking, rebuilding. Watch out, world, you ain't seen nothing yet, as a recent mobile ad was titled. Another ad has it this way. There's this stunning blonde, and she says, "Everything in moderation is about the dullest philosophy I ever heard." John Schramm loves this. You'll hear this ad more than once. "Without any question, I work too hard, at least 9 hours a day, sometimes 10. I definitely care too much for Lionel." Isn't that a crazy name? "My husband. But Lionel is my reward at the end of the day for working too hard. I also cook too passionately and play tennis to win, and on my last birthday I ate 40 Blue Point oysters. My favorite magazine says don't worry about too much as long as that too much makes you feel utterly fulfilled, utterly utilized, and usually utterly happy." I love that magazine. I guess you could say I'm that cosmopolitan girl. End of quotation. If you want to know the working theology of industrial capitalism, you read the ads. Okay? Well, there is a reply to Chicago. And it's from Anna replied to Bell's sort of all-engorging character of modernity. It's also a poem, or just a portion thereof. It's from T.S. Eliot's Choruses from the Rock. The endless cycle of ideas and action, endless invention, endless experiment, brings knowledge of motion, but not of stillness. Knowledge of speech, but not of silence. Knowledge of words, but ignorance of the word. Capital W. A fear by Eliot that we no longer know God in this kind of society, because our way of viewing the world ourselves has been altered in the process. Is there a way of reconnecting the economy, ecology, ecumenics, viewing the world as a public household, a single household? I don't know if we can get back to that. I think that's a challenge for us. In the New Testament materials, Paul's phrase, the divine economy, is God's rendering of new creation amidst the old. That is the divine economy. It's the renewing, the redeeming of creation. In fact, the word creation is a Old Testament word that's also taken from economic life. One buys back those who have been oppressed and held in bondage. The material world, biblically speaking, is the stuff of God's creation, and the mandate is to view it and to treat it sacramentally. That is, we're to handle the common fare with reverence and to see its origin and its destiny in God. We're to hold high the daily bread and drink as we hold high the bread and the wine of the sacrament. It's a different picture. It's not a picture there that says humanity has no active place in the transformation of the world around. That's a biblical picture from Genesis on down, having dominion. But it's a picture of seeing it all as a single totality and viewing it sacramentally. Understand, caring for it with reverence and with an eye to past and to future. And the Hebrew notion of immortality is that one lives on in the life of future generations. And so I make my decisions today in keeping with the well-being of those who are several generations ahead of me. Our whole sense of time has been altered. And I think, in conclusion, that it's related to energy. So I've just tried to make some connections between non-renewable energy resources, a way of looking at the world, and the character of our society. All right, we've got some time. We can chat about these things. Whatever. One where that was just a stretch and not a raised hand. Yeah?
Your story Nancy? About the train conductor made me think of my sister and I when we first became mothers. And I think for me that is the most transforming experience I probably will ever undergo. Until that point, I thought I had control of my life. If I would just get up earlier or be more efficient or be more organized, I could get everything done. I could get it done the way I wanted. This makes my husband sound like he's a real henpecked person. He just knew how to live with me. But my children could not be controlled in such a way. They were not willing to be on schedule. They would not conform to the way I wanted life to be. And I batted my head against the wall for a long time with them. And my sister's experience was the first week home from the hospital with her son, and of course he ran her ragged. And on Thursday evening, she said, "Well, tomorrow I can relax because it's Friday, and on Saturday I'll be able to sleep in." It's not a job like any other job.
Yeah, good example. Yeah, life has its own way of getting rid of the images by which we want to master it. I've talked along these lines before. One response that I've gotten has been one which said, "It sounds to me like you just want us all to be passive." And my response to that is that the contrasting image of an image of activity and human involvement is not passivity, it's receptivity. And the religious tradition is full, whether it's the mystical tradition or just the plain notion that life is a gift from God and has to be received, the religious tradition is one which I think sees the dynamic more in terms of transforming activity and an attitude of receptivity. But our whole mindset, to me, that response itself, "You just think that we should all be passive," that response itself is an example of the mindset. It can't think of any other alternative to activity except something that represents status, you know, just nothing happening, going nowhere, yeah, stasis. Mark?
I'm not sure if this is related, but it is something rooted to it. Matthew Fox's book on compassion has been very important to me in the last year and a half.
And it's in the bookstore. Mary likes us to say that.
I'm very concerned about the lack of compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder, what do you do about that lack of compassion? So I think of things like parenting for peace and justice. And all of a sudden I wonder, after what you said, is that engineering? And I don't really know how you go about, I don't even know what term to use anymore, engineering, creating, whatever, some feeling of compassion. I was wondering how you react to that. I mean, I see it as something that it's an active role that I'd like to play. Excuse me. But you talked about receptivity. And if there's any kind of insight you could give to that whole thing, I'd love it.
Well, let's work on it together. I haven't thought that through either. Part of it is, what is the framework in which you understand your activity, for example, raising kids, and the kind of directives and the hopes that you have and the way you want to fashion your home and the schedule and the peace. What is the framework within which you understand that activity? Now, my contention here is that the notion of an imperial self is one in which we set all else over against us, and to which we are not, in fact, in our manipulating of it, organically related. That is, it is not a reciprocity there. It's as if we were putting the pieces of an erector set together. The erector set doesn't affect us, or we affect it. The picture of receptivity, and I would say compassion, because you remember Matthew Fox's definition of compassion is one from Thomas Merton, which says it is to recognize the interdependence of all things. The picture, then, I would see of activity as parents and children, ourselves and the world around us here, is one in which we understand the reciprocity, in which we understand the organic character of that relationship. Something is happening on all sides. It's not the imperial self. It's not subject and object, it's subject and subject. It's not I and it, it's I and thou. So I, you know, when
That's not really very helpful.
Oh, that's too bad. You know that was 3 minutes of my time? I missed the train.
But that triggers in my mind the chapter on Jacob's ladder.
Yeah.
And Sarah's circle.
Yeah.
And it's really a matter of style, how you go about it. I mean, whether it's an authoritative manner or more of a democratic, we're in this together.
Yeah.
That.
But Sarah's circle and feminist theology in general is theology much more cognizant of, I mean, it's mother child. It's much more cognizant of the reciprocity, the organic character, the bonding, the nurturing manner. So what you call style is a pretty pregnant word, if I may say so. Yeah.
Maybe it's dangerous to throw those terms out too, but even if anybody isn't interested in buying the book, you can in one page see the 10-15 characteristics of Sarah's circle and Jacob's ladder, and just those 15 terms.
Yeah, poor Jacob's having a hard time today. He's beaten up on the banks of the river, and now you're putting him down for going up the ladder.
He did not.
No, he never climbed those. He never made it. And incidentally, Fox's point is that we have that image of climbing a ladder to God is one which we've read into that. You see in the spirituality through the centuries that image constantly, and it's a hierarchical view of the world where you. And it's not there in the story at all.
No.
And it's just all the more significant that that's how we understand it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I can see a couple of examples how what you're talking about works. Like, say, the Eskimos in their tough environment have to help each other and share everything. And I think they've learned to conserve what they have. Mm-hmm. And also, if I lived in Europe, I think I'd learn some other languages because it would be a practical help to me. But I don't know how I can break out of my own environment. You know, I work and I have a family. And, I hearken back to the simpler life, and I don't think I'm extravagant in my consumption, but, you know, I don't know how to get out of what I have to do. I have, you know, 24 hours and so much energy
I don't want to depress you, but one of the reasons for choosing the Jake, nor do I want to cast an atmosphere of resignation about the discussion, but one of the reasons for choosing the Jacob image is to highlight the fact that we may have worked our way into a box where the transformation is in part forced upon us.
Yeah,
we may be changed as voluntarily changing. Now, it's much better to be preferred if we would take those steps on our own and freely chosen rather than to have the changes forced upon us in a struggle of our own making, but a struggle not of our own choosing. It can't be done. You have to have other folks. I mean, you can't do it yourself. You've got to have other folks. You've got to do it together. You've got to be Sarah's circle. Yeah.
I was listening to a public radio station a while ago and heard a program, and I missed the first part of it, so I'm not sure who was speaking. The guy said, that this group of people in the scientific community had gotten together, and they had talked about the greatest problems facing our planet, and a number of them agreed that it was the loss of the diversification of the species on the earth. And he went into a fascinating talk, and he said that right now it's because of the loss of natural habitat, and right now our dependency in the earth is on like 80% of our food production is dependent on 20 different species of plants, and that we're losing the natural appearance of all of those plants because we're losing the natural habitat. We are currently losing one species a day. When in the time when the dinosaurs went extinct, which was a relatively fast rate of extinction of species, they were losing species every 1,000 years. And they say that is going to, because of the loss of natural habitat, it's going to increase until by the year 2000, I think it was, we're going to lose one species every hour. And it's because, not because of so much of the people destroying the species, but because of their loss of natural habitat.
Mm-hmm.
He said, one of the things you learn about tinkering is that if you play around with something, you save all the pieces. And he says, you know, you and I remember he went on to say that we're not even sure what a lot of this stuff does yet, and we're losing it. And it is something that is more irreversible even than running out of oil.
Yeah.
And he talked about the total irreversibility of that, and that in the medical community, for instance, you know, all of that, he says, we really don't realize how dependent we are on the diversification of plant and animal species. And if we lose that diversity, for instance, in Mexico, a year ago, they discovered a crop that's similar to corn, but instead of being an annual, it's a perennial. And it was off in some little mountain somewhere. But, you know, his point was, you know, a lot of that stuff, there's good stuff in it, and it's going down the tube.
Rene Dubos makes that same argument again and again and again. Who's the biologist at Yale? Lewis Thomas, Lives of a Cell. He argues, and I think actually there's a quotation in the Fox book in there, that he argues for a moratorium. He says, before we do anything more on nuclear research, that's his example, he said, let's understand all there is to understand about just one thing. Pick a microbe and figure out everything that's going on there. Just understand all there is to think about the tiniest thing. Just that's all. And then let's work our way from there. But let's not do anything until we've understood that. Let's not, you know, because of this irreversibility of tinkering with everything without understanding all the pieces, much less keeping them all around. Yeah.
Maybe we don't need to worry about the loss of that many species, because luckily we've come up with genetic engineering recently.
Yeah.
Jeremy Rifkin
says the next age is the age of biology. And he says this is the culmination, as far as he can see it, of this habit of mind where we see ourselves as masters, engineers, controllers. And would make, I mean, people make exactly that case. Kingsley Davis, prominent American social scientist, argues argues for further genetic research, because the benefits will increase our scientific and technological knowledge, and that has a spiraling effect. And here are his closing lines: when we have conquered our own, we will be able to conquer our own evolution, and the universe will be ours at last. The universe will be ours at last. Now, I mean, that is a picture of a certain stature in the scheme of things, which is rather boggling.
But, you know, it's we don't think very often how incredibly far out on the limb we have crawled. Like when 1974, when that corn blight hit the Midwest and we lost so much of the corn crop, how susceptible these genetically engineered hybrids are to things like disease. And, you know, that and they're so widespread. That we're not diverse anymore.
Yeah.
Everybody's growing the same kind of corn, and that you get a corn blight. And
well, many people argue that the same principles which apply to the what we call the natural world, by which we usually mean everything except ourselves, the natural world apply to society, namely that the principle of survival is a principle, and adaptation and survival is a principle of diversification. And the principle of extinction is a principle of irreversibly cutting off your options. for adapting. So it is a scary kind of thing. In that particular case, we've had some problems with the Green Revolution because some of those hybrids have been susceptible to things that they haven't adapted for. Our time is up. Thank you very much.